listening
to the CD Baby.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
DIY.
Musician.
Musician Podcast.
Hey there, and welcome to episode number 204 of the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast. My name is Kevin Bruner, and joining me is Chris Robley. Chris, how are you?
I'm doing good. How about you?
I'm doing well. It is going to be an action-packed show. Lots of great stuff to get into. The news section today, there is some must-listen-to news. So we've got that. Then we're going to be talking about Show.co. We had lots of requests to do an episode about Show.co, our marketing platform. So we're going to run through that in detail later on. And then after that, we are going to get to some listener calls and emails. And man, the calls keep getting better and better, just the quality and the execution of them. And we've got some great emails as well. We're getting to the point where we're getting enough calls that we might be able to just do a listener feedback show once a month or something like that. But lots of great stuff there. So that's what we're going to talk about.
Rumor has it that the questions are so good, you've needed to go to outside experts to get some of them answered.
I've been having to go to the lawyer well multiple times. And I also had to ask somebody else in-house to answer some more technical type questions with the delivery process. But it was an interesting enough question to include on the podcast. So yeah, great show. You'll want to hear the whole thing, the news, the show.co section, the calls. But first, Chris, we haven't podcasted yet together in this new year.
Yeah, happy new year.
Thank you.
Yeah, things for me are very busy, although not outwardly so. I'm kind of in the planning build up phase of a bunch of things. I'm going to do a crowdfunding campaign soon for a new album. I'm preparing kind of the final mixes and making music videos for an EP I'm going to hopefully put out by the spring. And then I'm in kind of rehearsals in preparation for a giant show that I'm doing in Portland, Oregon, where me and some really great musicians are going to recreate Peter Gabriel's Secret World live concert in its entirety with the props and the video screens and all that stuff.
Wow, that sounds exciting.
Yeah, lots going on. Too much going on.
Well, since we've talked, it was an interesting end of the year. Lots of momentum was happening on the Small Town Poets front. The funny thing was, you know, I'm a big advocate of having a photographer, hiring photographers to take great pictures of your show and in a way that, you know, allows you to release them over time. And we played a show that had some really great lights and stuff and played multiple times at the same place. And I had multiple photographers just take tons of photos. And so I was running that through our Instagram feed, just, you know, like every day I posted a different photo. And at the end of it, you know, leading up to like Christmas, I had people coming up to me that knew me and really actually had the opportunity to see that I was in town the whole time. I wasn't on tour, that thought I was on tour the whole time. Lots of people online thought we were doing this big, enormous tour. So it works, people. You get a ton of great photos and you don't sit there and go, another picture from the show we did 3 weeks ago. You just post a picture and say something interesting or whatever, but you don't keep highlighting that it's old. People don't know, and you give the impression that you're on tour. So I stayed home, and people thought I was out on the road touring.
Well played.
It was funny, because someone last week at church came to me like, man, I bet you're glad to be home. You've been out being a rock star. And I was like, it took me a while. I'm like, what is she talking about? I'm like, oh my gosh, because she does follow me. Follow the band on Instagram. Like, she totally thought we were on tour this whole fall.
And you just let her continue believing it, right?
Absolutely. So that was interesting. But after that, it's been a slow start to the year. All that momentum kind of came to a screeching halt. I've been sick since New Year's Day, and it's going on. If it continues into next week, it'll be going into week four. And it's been driving me crazy. Really tried to take it easy to get over it quickly, and that just didn't help. So then our mixing engineer was supposed to be mixing for 2 weeks in January. and he got the flu really badly and was only able to get through most of one song. And so we were hoping to have most of the record done, and we have nothing.
I heard you saying that the other day, and I typed something back to you, which I thought, after I wrote it, I said, that's very true. Music making is 90% setbacks and then 10% rushing.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where, you know, I had this plan that we'd release a single before Christmas and get a new song out in the Christmas season, but also take advantage of all the momentum that happens when our music gets streamed on Spotify, which it got a ton more activity than it did even last year. And, you know, and so I was hoping to have another single to pop out real quickly, and that, you know, now it's February before he has time in his schedule again to mix. And it's just like, at this point, it is what it is. I can't do anything about it. So I'm just not going to stress about it. But I have had some content that I've been working on to time with, you know, keeping some activity rolling. And so I'm kind of glad I didn't use it. And I kind of had to rework some of the plans. So it feels like it's just been sort of a blah entrance into 2018 for me. But it'll turn around.
Well, I can imagine the sickness on top of that loss of momentum, or not a loss of momentum, but I'm sure it feels like it.
Yeah, it felt like it, because we didn't know, you know, we had this 2-week window. We were doing all this work to make sure he had everything he needed. And then it's like, he kind of went MIA, but I guess he was really sick. I did finish one thing over the holiday season that I said I was going to do to everyone on the podcast. I read that book, The Gift. I highly recommend it. It's probably different than you would expect. It is not a music business how-to book or how to be an artist book by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, if you wanted to cheat, you could read the introduction and the conclusion at the end, but you would miss all the real in-depth meat in the middle that really kind of builds the foundation for his arguments. It's what people used to do before there were blogs and these books that people just released that really, you know, take 2 hours to read and are really just an extended blog post.
In fact, wasn't it written like in the 90s or earlier?
It was in I think it was in the 70s when it was originally written.
Oh, okay. So it was, another time.
But anyway, that was a good read. Lots of good thoughts about the pursuit of being an artist after reading that and what it all means and whatnot. But if you read it and we run into each other someday, I'd be happy to chat about it. And I know I'll run into you, Chris. I was saying that to our listeners.
I think we're going to run into each other like all over the world.
I know. Speaking of, Chris and I have booked our flights to the DIY Musician Conference in Europe, Valencia, Spain, coming April 14th and 15th. If you are in Europe, I highly recommend going. It is so cheap to get a hotel in Valencia. Food is cheap there, and it's an amazing city. And it's right on the Mediterranean Sea. It is such a cool spot, and it's so affordable. If you're in Europe, definitely make it. If you're in Spain, you have no excuse. Just come. Tickets are on sale at DIYMusicianCon.com/Europe. It's only 30 euros. It's so affordable, and some good things shaping up there. It's going to be a really fun, a smaller crowd, more community feel. I don't know. What would you call like a small
intimate.
Little
more intimate?
That's the word I'm looking for. It'll be a more intimate gathering, and you'll feel like you just get to hang out with a bunch of musicians and Chris and myself and a few other people from CD Baby and the Berkeley crew. It'll be fun. It'll be making memories that last a lifetime and getting great career advice at the same time. So be sure to get on that. And also the DIY Musician Conference in Nashville, August 24th through 26th. Those tickets are on sale. Early bird tickets are running out. We did it differently this year. That's not cutting off at a date. We're cutting it off at a certain amount of tickets sold, and we're getting close to that cutoff. So if you haven't bought your tickets for that yet either, do so at DIYMusicianCon.com. And with all of that out of the way, we need to get into the news. Hey there, this is Kevin. Just wanting to jump in here real quick. I realized while editing the podcast that I wasn't as clear from the top about what Show.co is. Show.co is a marketing platform, and if you use CD Baby for distribution, it's free to you. All you have to do is go to your member dashboard, click on the link for Show.co, and it'll connect to your account. Don't go to show.co directly if you're using CD Baby, because that way you'll create a separate account that you'll have to pay for. But if you go to your member account, it's right there for you. And if you haven't signed up yet, go ahead and do that. You could probably get it done during the news section, and then you'll be able to follow along with Chris and I and kind of build your campaign while we talk about it, and you can kind of see what's all in there and get started making your own show.co campaigns. So back to the news.
CD Baby.
Music.
News.
Well, Chris, some interesting news items popped up this week. And I don't know if you've noticed with the internet that a lot of people like to make erroneous news stories and put them out there on the web.
Everything has to be an emergency.
A sensational emergency. You're going to lose out on your life if you don't click on this thing. And, you know, there's been a couple, one in particular outlet that is notorious for doing that about happenings of the music industry. But I've been saddened to see other outlets that were more reputable starting to follow suit and putting out really poor information, making artists think the sky's falling. And we might have to start calling people out. I don't want to call anyone out by name. If they're listening, they know who they are. But my only conclusions are that either one, they're just doing it to get more clicks, which we know half the world is doing. They're just posting stuff that's untrue in order to get people to click. Or two, the music industry has really gotten very nuanced. And I have a feeling a lot of these people just don't even know what they're talking about, but they have a popular blog. Things have come a long way. It used to be simple. You sold a CD in the store, you got a song on the radio, it's easy to understand. Now there's all these little nuances about digital royalties for different types of usages, things that didn't exist in the past. And so news stories pop up and people make some outrageous claims that confuse artists. Especially it makes me angry when people sort of feel like they're intentionally misleading artists. One such story that came out this past week that we need to discuss, and I will read here, is Facebook and monetization and what artists need to do. So we wrote an article with correct information, and I will read it right now. So this is how indie musicians can monetize on Facebook. Big news. Facebook has been inking deals with labels, publishers, and other rights administrators in order to properly monetize music usage across the still dominant social media platform, plus Instagram and Oculus. If you're an independent artist, label, or songwriter, CD Baby has got you covered for all three of those platforms. Think of it. All those videos people have posted to Facebook over the years containing your music can now earn you money. With the massive amount of music being used on Facebook and with the introduction of a system-wide solution to help avoid copyright issues, this is going to be huge for the music industry. And it's not just a win for majors. Independent artists and songwriters will greatly benefit too. Important. Big important. And this is where the fake news comes in that has been propagated out there. A lot of reports out there are encouraging artists to act fast with messages that suggest you only have a limited window of opt-in time to direct license with Facebook, or urging you to create a new account with some third party where you have to add all your release info to yet another database. Once Facebook starts paying, many existing CD Baby clients won't even have to lift a finger to start collecting revenue. More to the point, you don't have to do anything else, assuming you're already taking advantage of CD Baby's YouTube monetization program and CD Baby Pro Publishing. Depending on your contribution to the music, there are two different Facebook revenue streams that artists and songwriters can tap into to make sure that your music is usable on Facebook and you're collecting all applicable royalties. Again, Facebook hasn't started paying right holders yet, but with CD Baby, you're at the front of the line and you'll be positioned to earn money from the social media service as soon as possible. So all those stories you're hearing out there, like, you must opt in now, you've got 60 days, disregard them. Just make sure you're covered with CD Baby. If you're signed up for YouTube monetization and are taking advantage of CD Baby Pro, you're covered on both sides. So that's the Facebook issue. Now let's move on to some YouTube news that went haywire. This is from the YouTube blog. On February 20th, 2018, channels with fewer than 1,000 subscribers or 4,000 hours of watch time will no longer be able to earn money on YouTube. When they reach 1,000 subscribers and 4,000 hours of watch time, they will automatically be reevaluated under strict criteria to ensure they comply with our policies. New channels will need to apply and their application will be evaluated when they hit these milestones. Though these changes will affect a significant number of channels, 99% of those affected were making less than $100 per year in the last year, with 90% earning less than $2.50 in the last month. Any of the channels who no longer meet these thresholds will be paid what they've already earned based on our AdSense policies. After thoughtful consideration, we believe these are necessary compromises to protect our community. So here's why they're doing this. People uploading hate content that was causing advertisers to flee when they saw their ads on those videos, and other general abuses, both people behaving badly and people trying to manipulate the system. Removing the payout component helps protect the advertisers and also helps bolster the real YouTube community. So, Chris, I ran some numbers because, you know, in that article, it kind of lays it out. And if you're wondering, it used to be that you had to have 10,000 subscribers to monetize your channel. And so still the bar is really low. If you are active on YouTube, trying to build a following on YouTube, getting to 1,000 subscribers and 4,000 hours of watch time isn't really that challenging if you're really trying to do YouTube like they say. So here's what I broke down, what 4,000 hours of watch time is, because that sounds like a lot. It equals 240,000 minutes. But if you divide that by 3.5, like, you know, an average maybe music video, that's 68,571 views. So I took the minutes, divided it by 3.5, like considering 3.5 equaled one view. That's 68,571 views. And you times that by a royalty that has been published online this past week, someone saying they released the Bible of royalties, like what the payouts are for all these services, which it's not entirely true. But I used that number that they posted. That equals $50. So all these headlines were running saying YouTube is destroying revenue streams for independent artists. One that was a big basic lie was saying no monetization for new artists. That is not true. It's no monetization for a brand new channel that has no audience. So if you're a new artist and you've got a big audience, you shouldn't have any problem getting, and you're serious about YouTube, you shouldn't have any problem getting to those thresholds. But there was all these stories about these people that could no longer afford to make YouTube videos because they were funding their YouTube videos based on these the revenue. If you didn't meet that threshold, you were only making $50 a year. So you can't tell me you were making all this money to make YouTube videos. So it was really frustrating to see.
I have a question.
Oh, go ahead.
So through our content ID program that we offer, aren't, you know, for instance, I don't have 1,000 subscribers, but aren't my videos still being monetized through content ID?
The ones with music. So that's the important thing. This is only referring to a channel. So if you don't have a YouTube channel, or you have a channel that you parked a video on, but you don't really take YouTube seriously, you weren't monetized there anyway. This is, your channel was probably not monetized. And if it was monetized and you're not really actively using it, it wasn't making money anyway. But content ID is a separate thing, but that monetizes your music. So if you've got your music on your channel, yes, that will still be monetized. So it's one of those things where YouTube had this high limit, 10,000 subscribers. Sort of the nature of subscribers and how people subscribe changed, so they lowered it almost to nothing. And then they had some big issues with hate content, people trying to game the system, a lot of garbage being added to the system just by, like, people trying to manipulate things and, you know, trick advertisers and, you know, keyword stuffing and all that garbage that just ruins everything for everybody. So they're trying to back it up a little bit to a threshold that's pretty much like, if you're only making $50 a year off YouTube, you don't have a grand YouTube strategy. So that's where they settled in. And, you know, if you honestly want to get back to that threshold, the way to do it is just by optimizing and going about YouTube like they outline. I've seen several channels recently start from scratch and get to 4,000 or 5,000, 10,000 subscribers within a couple weeks just by doing it like YouTube outlines. It really works. The only people that I thought of that could potentially be damaged that were making money is randomly this came up in a conversation, videos of like white noise. And if you search YouTube, you'll see a video for white noise. And I think it has like 50 million views. Now there's a channel that could, that person who uploaded it could realistically have far less than 1,000 subscribers, but clearly they have a lot of watch time. So I don't know if in that case, YouTube might make an exception because clearly it's getting millions and millions of views, or if that channel owner who just randomly uploaded a video of white noise.
I'm picturing them saying, you know, subscribe so that you can get more white noise next week.
You did not have enough like, noise in your life?
The same thing every week.
So the other thing was that I thought of is there could be some keyword driven video. So it'd be possible for me to upload a video that is just totally keyword driven, like something that's a popular keyword search that brings up a video that fits the keyword, like, you know, calming nature scenes. That would be potentially one, like where there's music and calming nature scenes. That I've seen videos like that do have lots of views and get used a lot, but the channel that posts it, no one's following that channel just because of that one video, you know. So for the most part, for artists, I think the change will ultimately be positive because you don't want advertisers leaving YouTube because there's all sorts of hate content being monetized. That's getting no views, but an advertiser sees or someone screenshots an advertiser advertising in front of, you know, a Nazi video and they go crazy and they pull their advertising dollars and we all suffer because suddenly all that revenue is leaving the system. So ultimately, I think it's a positive change. But the main thing that gets me frustrated when people mischaracterize things and mislead artists is that it causes people to make bad decisions about what positive change needs to happen. So yes, I want artists to get paid more. Let's talk about it, understanding all the benefits and the things that need to be improved and get to some long-term solutions and not just get clickbait out on the internet and people wound up and going crazy and wanting to burn down a company because of some random article. That's what frustrates me the most about it. That's it. I'm off my soapbox. That's the news.
I have to say that was a long, long news section / rant, but I think it was worth letting you just go on that tirade.
Well, I'll listen to it again when I edit this thing, and we'll see how much of it stays.
No, I mean, I think for most people, it's probably instructive, so... And I have to say, I even got fooled a little bit by the YouTube headlines this week. I thought it was more of a big deal at first than I realized, you know, a day later. But those headlines, they can grab you.
Yeah, and oftentimes, most people don't read anything else other than the headlines. And once you read 10 negative headlines about something, it's really hard to get your brain to accept that maybe you were misled. I mean, that's something that, you know, so many... things we see out there are just, it's not even someone who's ignorant on issues. They're actually trying to mislead us and get us angry for some other agenda. We have no idea why. Can't we all just sit down and relax and have interesting and in-depth conversations that help move the world forward together?
Wow. What a dream. If every conversation was like Intelligence Squared, which is another podcast people should listen to.
All right. Well, we're going to move on to the topic at hand for this episode and discuss our marketing platform, Show.co. We've had lots of requests for this topic. So I'm excited to dive in and sort of give you guys a tour of the options there and how to use it and to understand how it can be used properly and how it can be used in a different way that won't help you. But anyway, I'm going to start with a quick overview of what it is, and then Chris is going to dive into what's the different things you can do with it. So basically, Show.co is a marketing platform. It was designed to actually run marketing campaigns. So this is not the place where you just go park your latest album or catalog. There are ways where you could do that, but that's not what this is. We have a different thing called Here Now for that. This is not the album feature page where the ultimate link to send all your fans through so they can find your music where they want. That's Here Now. This is a campaign-driven platform. So it's intended to have something you want your fans to do. And it makes a quick landing page, and it's a quick way to funnel fans through there where it strips out a lot of garbage. You know, so you've got a landing page for your campaign, and it makes it easy to just monitor stats based on your campaign. So you know the reason why people are clicking or aren't clicking is because your campaign is effective or it needs work. So you really got to think about campaigns. I know a lot of times artists think about things of like, oh, this is a place where I can park my music so I can link people to and tell them to go listen. This is not really that spot. There are some things that, you know, there's a little bit of overlap in a couple areas we'll get to, but that is not it. This is a campaign creation tool. And Chris, what kind of things can I do with my show.co campaign page?
Yeah, so there's four kind of top level campaign types. And I think I should say up front that a lot of the stuff you can do, you can kind of mix and match different features of each of these, which I'm sure we can talk about later. But at the top level, there's YouTube, which is a way to grow your YouTube, you know, boost your YouTube views and to feature a video on a, like you said, a dedicated landing page where it's sort of attractively nestled amongst this experience that you're trying to create, rather than someone just going to YouTube and then being distracted by all the ads and all the other videos. This puts all of the focus on your video. The next one is SoundCloud, which is, you know, similarly, you feature a SoundCloud track. And with both of these, the YouTube and the SoundCloud categories, as the person is watching the video or listening to your song, you can surface these things called conversion cards. Basically, that's a fancy way to say while they're watching, a nice little attractive bubble appears and says, hey, do something. And that can be any number of things that we could talk about later. But, you know, follow me on Facebook, sign up for my email list, any of that kind of stuff. The third campaign type is email for download, which is pretty self-explanatory. You know, you get their email and you give them something. And the last one is called Social Unlock, which there's a lot of different kinds of Social Unlock campaigns. Three of them relate to Spotify. So basically what this, when we say lock, you are gating something. You're locking some experience or some web page or some document or file behind this gate, and they have to take a specific action before they can access that. And so the different types of Social Unlock campaigns, there's a Spotify follow, Spotify pre-save, where someone gets to save your song before it's even released, and then on the day it drops, they get it served into their song queue. There's also Spotify add to my music, which is basically a similar thing, but only it's for music you've already released. Spotify add to playlist. And then there's Twitter follow, YouTube follow, and SoundCloud follow. So basically someone takes one of those actions and then they can get to the next step in this campaign, which really can be anything. I don't know if you want to get into that at this point, but
I think where I want to start is, you know, what you need to think about when getting started. So you laid out some interesting things there. Everything from possibly featuring a YouTube video in a way that's more effective than sending someone to YouTube. So like a video premiere where you want to control the experience, or, you know, like email exchange for download or social unlock. So there's some options there. So you kind of getting started, I think you need to figure out what are you trying to accomplish? Because this isn't just an artist landing page. You could throw up a SoundCloud track or YouTube thing and kind of send that around as instead of a website. And it does look very nice. It's very clean. And it's a great way to do that. But ultimately, that is not what the tool is intended to do. So you need to figure out what you're trying to accomplish, whether it's more YouTube subscribers or, feature a video is one, drive email subscriptions, Spotify follows.
Basically, it seems like what you're saying is you need to start with a goal and then you need to determine whether you have the assets to attract people to take action to get towards that goal. And earlier when I said you can kind of mix and match features of these things, like an example of that would be you've got a YouTube video. Now, the purpose of your YouTube campaign could either be to get as many views of that video as possible. It's a new music video. You're excited. You want people to watch it there. So you can also maybe have them take some other actions. Or the YouTube video could be used as the carrot to get their email. So then you gate the YouTube video. And then the primary goal is not necessarily to boost the YouTube views, but to grow your email list. They're kind of the same elements at play in a way, but with different goals.
Yeah. And it's really intended to get your fan base to take a specific action. So when you're starting to put together a show.co campaign and trying to figure out what you want to do, you got to start with that action. So the piece of content that you have, say email in exchange for a download, the action is not listening to the download per se. And what I'm saying this, the action is I want to collect more email addresses, or I want to drive Spotify followers, or I want people to view the video or subscribe to me on YouTube or subscribe on SoundCloud or, whatever the specific action you're trying to get people to do. So you need to start with that and then start building the campaign around that. So one of the most popular ones is the social unlock, which includes the Spotify functionality. It could also be other social platforms, like Chris said. But the Spotify feature has really been the popular one. So as an artist, I want more people following me on Spotify. So that's the action I want them to take. But that's not how I should form the campaign if I want to see strong results. Would you agree with that, Chris?
I'm with you so far.
Okay. So the idea being that as artists, a lot of times we think about, I want people to follow me on Spotify. So we go tell them, follow me on Spotify. Or we think, I want people to sign up for my email newsletter. So we think, sign up to be added to my email list. Those things in and of itself aren't bad. But when you're using show.co, the idea is if you get far more creative, and this is how I was thinking of it, is that the action that you want people to take, whether follow or email or subscribe to YouTube, that becomes the payment for the experience, not the point. So don't make the headline, follow me on Spotify. So for example, one that I did for Small Town Poets, and we've mentioned it on the podcast before, but the action I wanted people to take was to follow us on Spotify. So I gated a live recording of a song that we used to do as a medley of 70s songs from the 70s. And one person did not, at a venue we were playing at, did not appreciate us playing cover songs. Long story. And so we actually got pulled off the stage mid-song, sounds out in front of like 4,000 people. It was quite confusing, but it makes for a great story. So the headline of the campaign was, hear the song that got us kicked off the stage. And so the payment for hearing the song that got us kicked off the stage is either following us on Spotify or entering your email address in. And then, quite frankly, once people have done that, I don't care if they listen to the song. I deliver on the promise. They get to hear the song. Once they click on those things, it takes them to a private SoundCloud link, and so there they can hear it. But really, what I'm trying to do is get something intriguing and deliver on that promise. I don't want to do like we were talking about with fake news, get clickbait. But I'm really crafting it around something interesting and intriguing for the end user, the people I want to be fans or want to follow us, and not just telling them what I want them to do. So then the subheader on ours was, follow us on Spotify or join our email list to hear the song that once resulted in us being kicked off the stage right in the middle of the performance. You'll love it. So at that point, yeah, it's intriguing enough. They're like, all right, I'll do it, you know.
And you've mentioned this a couple times, but I feel like it's repeating, worth repeating as its own point, in that if you're, you've set your objective as to get more Spotify followers, you've created this enticing little mystery and people want to know what song got you kicked off stage, but not all your fans are on Spotify. So as to not exclude them from unveiling the answer to the mystery, like, you can also have the email subscribe function go kind of alongside all of these social unlock things. So if someone's not on Twitter, you know, they don't fit into your primary objective, they can still help you and still get what they want.
Yeah, I think that's a feature I really like because of what you said. When I was putting this on Facebook, my ultimate goal was hoping people would follow us on Spotify, but I added it to the email option because, you know, I've noticed by what links people click on in our emails and some other tools I've used that there's a decent amount of our audience that uses iTunes still, Apple Music, and some other services. So I don't want to assume that people can only, or, you know, I don't want it to be a dead end for people. Like, if someone doesn't use Spotify, I still want them to give me some sort of collateral to access the content. So the email address is perfect. So ultimately, when you do these campaigns, you can see inside your show.co dashboard the conversion rate, the amount of traffic, where it came from. It's like four or five key, really actionable pieces of marketing data that really help you tailor the campaign. So it's like, hey, I sent the email list, my whole email list, a link here with what I thought was an intriguing campaign, and only a few people followed us to get access to the content. Well, try a different headline. Maybe the content isn't that interesting. Tweak some things and then try it again. And you'll see, you know, conversion percentages and how many people, you know, do the action inside the dashboard. And it really simplifies the idea of marketing.
And that brings up a good point to repeat. CD Baby clients get access to this tool for free at a level in which they can have two campaigns live at any time. So if you want, you could create two similar but, you know, somewhat competing campaigns and run them with different audiences, or, you know, A-B test them, figure out which one's doing better, and then kind of put your effort into streamlining that one so it's as good as can be. But, you know, at any time, use both of them and measure the results.
Yeah, that is definitely something that we should emphasize, that if you use CD Baby for distribution, then you get this tool for free. And it's something that a lot of major label companies have been using to promote releases. The folks that manage all of Oasis there and the Gallagher brothers, their projects, they use this constantly to run contests and give away tickets and things like that. I know Britney Spears folks used it to give away a onesie.
That's a great prize. I know with Oasis or with Noel Gallagher, they were getting like 80 to 90% conversion rates, which is like astronomical.
They're a good example of using this product. So when we acquired this marketing platform, I saw they were using it. So I got them on a call and wanted to talk through how they were approaching it. The person that was running all these marketing campaigns, they were from their label. And they said, our problem is, you know, we've got this classic catalog that, you know, its heyday, it's still very popular, but its heyday was in the CD era. And we're trying to jumpstart the audience on Spotify. So we're trying to get these fans moved over to new platforms. And so they were using the Spotify follow functionality for contest entry. So if you want to win tickets to a concert, follow us on Spotify and you'll be in the pool to win. So they were doing a whole bunch of things like giving away box sets, just continually doing that.
Box sets, yeah, right.
And they were getting an enormous return from it, like unbelievable. And it really built their audience on Spotify. You'll see they have a massive presence on Spotify now. And so that's how they were using it. They had a specific thing. I want to build, get this audience that has been traditionally more CD focused, moved over onto Spotify. Here's how we're going to do it. We're going to run contests where you got to follow us on Spotify in order to be entered to win. And they were getting thousands and thousands and thousands of people for every contest. And they were just singing the praises of the platform just because it was working so well. And so that's how you got to think about it.
I wanted to clarify just one point we were making earlier, just so no one feels misled. The one functionality that's not included at the free level right now is the Spotify pre-save thing. You can do Spotify follow, you can do Spotify add to my music, all that stuff at the free level. The reasoning being that right now there's a few extra steps involved in that, kind of behind the scenes steps. But if you're launching a bunch of singles, I think it's still worth maybe investing at the premium level for the duration of those campaigns and doing a pre-save, because it can really boost your first day streaming activity, which is good for Spotify noticing you.
Yeah, if you get the premium account, which the only difference between a premium account and the CD Baby level is the number of campaigns you can run at the same time and this feature. And the main reason is we're building the tool in order to get what is Spotify needs, which is called a URI number. So basically, once your music gets delivered to Spotify and it's sitting there in their system for a future release date, they generate the URI number. And you need that URI number in order to do a Spotify pre-save, which is basically the same idea as doing a pre-sale on iTunes. Your fans can go, they can pre-save it, and the day it comes out, it hits everybody's music library on Spotify at the same time, and it kind of tells Spotify that there's a lot of activity around this release, and maybe the algorithm gets juiced a little and things happen. So that's the idea behind that. To do a pre-save for Spotify, you really have to have your music like distributed out there in like a future release date of like a month, similar to what you would think of as a pre-save with iTunes and Apple Music. I mean, a pre-sale with iTunes and Apple Music. That if you're trying to do it like, hey, my album was distributed to Spotify yesterday, and it's coming out 3 days from now, that's not enough lead time.
So
you need lead time.
And actually, I did write a whole article about this topic if people are curious how much advanced planning you need and what the steps are. I forget exactly what it's called, but it's on the DIY Musician blog. Something about boosting your streams through a Spotify pre-save campaign, I think is what it's called. So check that out.
I looked through a bunch of active campaigns that independent artists have put up, you know, excluding stuff that the major label artists were doing. And the common thing that I saw was that people were just saying, enter your email address, follow me on Spotify. That was the headline they were using. They weren't really leveraging the tool like it's intended to. So what you really need to do is start thinking about what interesting content can I create to use the, like I mentioned, the email or the follow as the payment to get access to. So people will gladly want to follow me on Spotify to get to the thing that they're interested in. You can just use it as an email collection tool or a way for just tell people to go there to follow you on Spotify, but that kills a lot of the power of getting people there, getting them intrigued and wanting them to push the follow button in order to get access to something.
Yeah, well, and I think there's a real simple way, even if your intention is just to get someone to listen to a song, instead of saying, hey, check out this, follow me on Spotify and hear my new song. Like, that's pretty boring. You could do almost the same campaign, change the headline to have some kind of mystery or emotional appeal or something. And, you know, one that I saw, I liked, I forget the exact wording, but it was something like, this song is the reason I moved 400 miles from home or something like that. It's just a slightly different spin on the exact same content. And suddenly I'm intrigued.
Yeah, I mean, think about some story piece of yourself as an artist that might be intriguing to somebody. You know, some old footage you have. I don't have a need to use this now, but the band Hello Morning that I was in here in Portland for a while, there was an incident where one of the other guys.
A bloody incident?
Yes. One band member who would look like a possessed animal for whatever reason at the end of one song just randomly was just going so crazy, randomly swung his guitar, like holding it almost like a baseball bat. You can still see it. It's on YouTube. And whacked our lead singer over the head. And I had no idea any of this was happening at the time. And until because it was our last song, and I walked backstage and our lead singer was stumbling around with just massive amounts of blood coming out of his head. So I had it, somebody videoed the whole thing. And so stuff like that. Now, you don't want to gross people out necessarily, but that kind of content you may have laying around like, oh, something funny, something like, oh my gosh, we can't believe Henry survived this blow to the head. Like, well, now I've got to see this. And so just think about something intriguing or, you know, an alternate version of a song. That's something simple you should be able to do. Here's an acoustic version of my hit song, only available here. May not be as intriguing, but depending on who your audience is and depending on the song, it may be. Or if you do a collaboration with somebody that you have on video, just thinking about anything that you might have that's already in your arsenal that you can just tell a story around that's intriguing enough that people want to follow you on Spotify to get access to it.
And also, it doesn't even really need to be your content. An example of this is that I created a campaign. I think it was called, I thought I was opening for Ringo Starr, but ... or something like that. And it was a story where I was asked to play on this I wasn't on the same stage as him, but it was this property where he was going to be playing a concert and I was going to do all Ringo and Beatles songs kind of in for the audience in preparation. And I showed up and it was the week before I went to that property and I was asking about the Ringo show and someone was like, what are you talking about? Ringo's like 2 months away. Next week is Lynyrd Skynyrd. And I thought, oh my God, what happened? So, I had to retool the whole thing. And then as I was playing my show and throwing a few Beatles songs in there, just cause at that point, people were requesting Freebird nonstop. And so anyways, the whole campaign was, I thought I was opening for Ringo Starr, but follow me on Spotify to find out. And then it leads you to a Freebird in 1977 YouTube video. So not even my content, but it reveals the mystery and it ties into, ties into my story. And I give a little bit of text context before you get to the video, but anyways, another method of putting a campaign together.
Yeah. So think about things that might get people talking, might get people, if you're looking at your Facebook feed, what are the posts that got people engaging or interested or interacting? What were those topics? And maybe think of something that can work around that, something that is a piece of your story or a piece of content that might be intriguing or, those kind of things that, you think will be interesting enough that people want to, give their email address or follow you on a platform. And it's okay if you fail. That's the beauty of this platform. You can try something that didn't work, try something else. Now, that's a lot of, we talked a lot about the emails in exchange for content or follow on Spotify for exchange for some content. I would like to talk about the video premiere or follow on YouTube aspect. There is some, like we said, it's a great platform to release a official music video. So when you're writing that headline, get more creative than just writing official music video. I saw a lot of that. Use it as a way to engage with the people that are there. So if you're sending all your fans and say there's going to be a lot of traffic, you're premiering the official music video here, they click on it, don't just say official music video at the top. Say something, you can put the title of the song or whatever, but then you've got like 2-sentence space to say something intriguing. You can also encourage people to subscribe to your YouTube channel or, share it or whatever, but try to think more like You've got your fans coming to a place. What would you like them to do? Don't just tell them something they already know, that it's an official music video. Think about what you want them to do. Have someone look over the grammar. That's always another thing. I saw a campaign today, had some pretty rough grammar going on, and it kind of just made the experience confusing. Reread stuff. Go, you know, click on a link, you know, use the link, click on it and land there and kind of survey the experience yourself, because, you know, a lot of times when you're making these things, especially when you're using a tool and you're in the back end, it's easy to just kind of slap stuff together and realize in context, it's not really making a whole lot of sense. So really check out the different options there.
Real quickly to review, I would say create curiosity, make an emotional appeal, focus on clarity as much as you can, like make your calls to action or your description of the campaign as short as you can, you know, not just because there's a character limit, but because people don't like reading stuff. So as succinct as you can be. And then let's see. Oh, pictures. Pictures are super important. Basically, with show.co, you can upload a really large picture and then play with the blur settings. You can play with the light or darkness of the text. All that stuff is really important to make the campaign pop, because when we're scrolling through existing campaigns artists are running, it's just kind of a head scratcher why so many of them are just a blank campaign with just like a color or something. You're wasting a huge opportunity right there to create some extra vibe or context.
Yeah, the tool does let you create a campaign just with like some easy editing features, so you don't have to use a photo. But when you look at the ones with a photo compared to ones without, the ones with a photo are so much more interesting looking, especially if you're trying to get people to grasp onto some sort of story piece. If they go to just some page where there's just text, it doesn't feel as much like a part of you. But if there's at least a band photo,
well, then it just feels like a widget to me.
Yeah.
You know, without a picture, it's just a widget. Whereas if you really take time to upload, you know, a really good looking photo that resonates with what you're trying to get people to do, then it suddenly feels like it's yours and it's this experience you're making.
When you pull that out, like you said, yeah, it just feels like a widget as opposed to a piece of the experience of the artist. Oh, I was going to say a contest for sure. Because when you go to a contest page and it has pictures of, you know, like, the Oasis folks, they a lot of times would show pictures of the box set or whatever. It feels like, oh, I'm entering this thing that's a part of Oasis that the band is doing. When you go to just some random page and it's just an email field saying, enter your name into a contest, it kind of feels like entering the publisher's clearinghouse thing. It's like you do it, but you know nothing's ever going to come. It doesn't feel real. It is not
right.
It is not anchored in a story or an experience of an artist.
Oh, while we're on the topic of photos, I mentioned playing with the blur settings, and that's important if you have like a real crisp image with a lot of different details, because you want the text in front of that picture to pop. So, you know, even just adding a tiny bit of blur can help with that. And also while you're picking your image, it helps if you pick something that like in the center part of the image is either very light or very dark, so you can choose the opposite color text to contrast against it.
Yeah, those tools are super easy to use, but those are, like you said, those are things to pay attention to. If you've got a photo, like I saw one today, it's a band photo and the artist, it's an artist photo, and the artist is on like the right side of the frame. And then the rest of the image was just white. The campaign will sit perfectly over that, and you don't have to blur the photo. But if it's a busy photo, that blur setting, it's super easy. You just pull it back a little bit, and it allows the text to be more legible. I've seen a lot of campaigns where someone uploaded a very busy photo, left it, you know, perfectly crisp and clear, and then the copy over top of it is like, you know, the photo's darker. They used had the font black, and now you can barely read it. So people don't want to land on your page and try and figure out what they're supposed to do or how to read the copy, or if they struggle, they'll just leave. So those are all little tools it has that, and little tricks of optimizing that help make sure that the focus is on the right thing.
Yeah, I think also when you're, to kind of shift gears a little bit, when you're thinking about the effectiveness of these campaigns and, you know, maybe you launch a campaign and it's not doing as well as you thought it would. Well, think about who you sent it to. Are you sharing, you know, a track from your previous album with your existing email list? Well, that probably won't do that well because chances are those people have already heard that song. There's nothing new in it for them. As opposed to taking the exact same campaign and targeting it, you know, on Facebook to friends of your followers or, you know, some other targeted demographic that likes similar music but has never heard your music before. If you just adjust the audience a little bit, it can make all the difference in the world is without changing a single thing about the wording or the content or anything.
Yeah. And that's why I love this tool because it puts the focus on the marketing aspect. All the little adjustments are super easy and it lets you really break down a marketing campaign to its bare bones. I want something I want people to do. How am I going to get them to do that? Well, I'm going to offer them something and then I'm going to ask them to take an action to access it. And I've got some simple things that I can see. And if it's not working, I can make tweaks. And sometimes, you know, you think your headline's really clear, but then, you know, you might look at it again after the campaign doesn't perform well and think, you know what? I really didn't tell them what I want them to do. I just made a statement and then there's an email box there. So of course people aren't going to put their email
in. Which is exactly what I did last week. And you gave your feedback about,
I mean, it's
move a couple words around and clarify.
Yeah. I mean, that's something that we do in marketing all the time here. It's not like, it's not like you should feel like a dum-dum if you don't, hit it out of the park at first. It takes a lot of wordsmithing at times, especially when you have limited amount of words. You know, I got to get this out in a headline. I can't, you know, write a paragraph in order to tell people what to do. They're not going to read it and it's too much anyway. So it takes wordsmithing and sometimes things aren't as clear as you hope. And you look at it again and you're like, yeah, let me change this. Suddenly people are converting. And then that's what this tool is so great for. So I would love if you've been using show.co to run campaigns and it's been working great for you. I would love for you to post a link to it in the show notes of this episode so other artists can see it and give us some information about, you know, how you came about with it. If it's like a special piece of content that you knew your fans would love or something that, you know, provide a little context. And if you want to share some of the stats, that'd be great too. So if you've been using this tool, I'd love for you to go to that. Go to the comments, leave a link, and I'll be checking them out. And I'm sure other people will as well. And if you want to get show.co and you're using CD Baby for distribution, all you have to do is log into your member account and there's a link on your dashboard that will connect your account so you can get signed up for free. Do not go directly to show.co and sign up. That will create a separate account and it'll make you pay. Go to CD Baby. Log into your account, click the link on the dashboard, and you'll have your free account that gets you everything right now that the premium package does, except for that pre-save functionality, but that will be coming in the near future. So just hang in there for that piece.
And I had one last thought about this. We've been using the word landing page a lot when we're talking about these campaigns, and I spoke disparagingly about a widget, but it actually can behave as an embeddable widget as well. So if you want to use, let's say, like an email for download campaign as a sidebar feature of your homepage on your website, that's totally fine too. You just basically take a widget version of the landing page. It's very easy to do on the back end. So it doesn't always need to be about driving people to this particular landing page. Sometimes the landing page can go to them.
Yeah, and we discovered an interesting feature just today. Chris and I did with something we're using right now on the DIY Musician blog, where you have to enter an email address in order to gain access to a video that Chris made. And it's embedded in the blog as the widget. And we realized that once you convert, your users no longer have to see that conversion message. So it cookies in the browser. And so it makes it a cool opportunity to put like the widget into your homepage at the top saying, my new music video is out. Subscribe to my email list to see it. and they subscribe, and then it shows the video right there in the widget space. So they don't even have to leave the page. When they come back, they will no longer see that email box that they have to enter. They'll just go right to the video. I thought that was a cool feature. I didn't know that that was built in that way. So it makes it really useful on your own website so that your fans don't get annoyed. Like every time they go, they have to enter their email address to see it. Once they do, they've got access and it holds it for them. So that was a really cool feature that, you know, you can try out with all sorts of different campaigns. It's most useful for like a SoundCloud link or a video feature or something where they're going to access the content right there that they might want to access over and over again. You know, the social unlock, I don't think that would really work with that. And I bet the campaign, the widget won't function the same way. So we haven't tested that out yet. But anyway, that was something cool that we figured out today. Like I said, try it out. Also, if you got some tips for using it or want to talk about a campaign that worked for you, feel free to call our listener line at 360-524-2209 or email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com. And I mentioned that we've been getting some fantastic emails and calls, and we have. They've been really great and interesting and sort of exactly what we wanted the spirit of this show to be. People calling in with great tips or questions and being able to share with the community of artists as well, or, you know, something that might be a question that lots of people are thinking. So we've got a lot of calls and they're all good and I want to get to them all. So we're going to do that right now.
Hello, Kevin and Chris. This is Matthew Seifel Anderson. Hey, I've got two questions. Number one, I've got a buddy of mine who likes to songwrite, but he doesn't have any interest in signing up with a PRO. And I am trying to take my career a little more seriously, and I keep trying to encourage him to sign up, but he is resistant. So my question is, what if I write a song with him? How do I give him credit if he's not signed up to a PRO? Or what would you do in that situation? Or should I just tell him he can't be my friend anymore? Second question is about music in a podcast. I do a podcast and I use my own music. YouTube creates a copyright claim, which is all great. I know that's good. But my question is, could there be any problems with iTunes or Spotify flagging the music I'm using? And how should I deal with that? Or is it not even a concern? And how do you guys deal with it? So thanks for the question. Thanks for the great podcast. You can find everything I do at mysaviorsanthem.com. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Chris, you want to take that first question?
Yes. So if you co-write a song with him, you can certainly sign it up and register it with a PRO. But the problem is that's still not going to do anything for him getting affiliated with the PRO. So even if the song's generating money and the splits are properly accounted for and everyone knows you wrote half of it and he wrote half or whatever, you'll get paid, but he won't. So he still would need to affiliate with a PRO, and then they'll know who to pay.
Yeah, basically he would just be flushing any money down the toilet because they would assume it's unpublished or that they just don't know who the publisher is. And I don't know how long ASCAP might hold on to that money for, but as long as you guys agree on the split and you give ASCAP the information, you can even use CD Baby Pro, our pro publishing administration service. If, you know, you wrote half the song, we'll just administer your half and, you know, his half will just go uncollected. So you're fine there as far as the PRO thing is concerned. So you can remain friends. As far as music in a podcast, yes, on YouTube will, you know, using Content ID, flag it. And, you know, I'm assuming you're using the Content ID program. So yes, you're correct. That's fine. That's not a problem. Apple doesn't host the podcast. All they do is host a directory. So they don't even know what people post. If they remove podcasts because of content, it's probably because listeners have reported abuse or something like that. They wouldn't. So it's not like you distribute to iTunes. It's just a directory that they house. Spotify is different in that getting a podcast on Spotify is harder. Again, I would assume that they are just using it as a directory. I know that currently the podcasts that are on Spotify typically use Libsyn as a podcasting platform, and I wouldn't assume that there's any issue with music in there. However, podcasting keeps reaching new and new heights, and that's going to be an issue that somebody's going to bring up at some point when they feel like there's enough money in the game to be worth beating people over the head for usage of music. So if I know Spotify just this past week announced some features that are going to be more prominently featuring podcasts and other content on the platform, that will definitely start raising the profile, and especially if they're housing the audio files. That's really key. That you typically, when people try to create systems to pay for music, it's got to be housed by like a big entity that can account for it, like how YouTube does. But right now, Apple doesn't really house those files. It's just a directory. So who knows what will happen in the future, but right now they're not going to come after you or do anything for your own music especially. So I hope that helps. Let's move on to the next call.
Hi guys, here's a question that's perplexing me. When you play a gig at a place and the bartenders are there and they give you a complimentary meal afterwards and stuff, is the right thing to do to give them a tip for feeding you and stuff at the end of the night or not? I mean, we're working for tips, they're working for tips, and I'm just not sure what you think the right protocol for that is. So be curious to hear your thoughts on that. Okay, thanks. Bye.
So I think always tip them because basically, like, I mean, it's just friendly, but also the service that they're doing, whether it's serving you a drink or giving you food, doesn't change just because you're a musician. That being said, I've been in plenty of circumstances where I've tipped them and then they actually tip me back. And that's great. Like, they're recognizing what I do, I'm recognizing what they do. All good. If they don't tip you back, like, whatever, then you just parted with a few dollars to stay on their good side.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, venue by venue, the power of said bartender may be different. They may be working the bar, but also help book bands during the day. You never know.
Right. In fact, Craig talked about that in the previous podcast about booking bands.
Yeah. So, you know,
the power of the bartender.
The reason why I included this call, because I thought, you know, there are these times, especially on low paying gigs where you might just be working for tips, where you feel kind of used and abused, and, you know, the bartender might be feeling the same way. But ultimately, I feel like as an artist, you should try to treat everyone with as much respect and the way you'd want to be treated, in hopes that, one, they ask you back if you do want to go back, or two, that you just leave a good impression and just practice being a good citizen, and the reputation around you as an artist is a good one. And you never know where some people will go. People that work at bars and clubs, they bounce around. It's pretty common for someone who's worked bar at one place to book another place and, you know, really work the scene. So chances are, depending on your city, you may come across them again in some other capacity and go, dang, wish I'd left a better taste in their mouth about me than what I did.
And I've never been in their shoes, but I can easily imagine a scenario where, like, let's say they're not, like, maybe they don't love your music all that much or whatever, but you're professional, you showed up on time, and then you gave them a tip. Like, if the, you know, the talent buyer is like, what do you think? That might make all the difference for them being like, yeah, you should have them back, as opposed to they kind of didn't like your music and then you don't tip them and now you're forgettable.
Agreed. That's also a good take on it. I like that. But yeah, the bartender's the one that's probably in the room watching and the club booker isn't. And they're going to ask for some feedback. Yeah. And that might, you know, turn a 2-star review into a 4-star review or a 5-star review. All right. Thanks for that call. Here's another one.
Hi, guys. My name is Tim Yorty. I love your show. I do my music under the name Yorty. People can find me at yortymusic.com. My question is why you guys don't ever seem to talk about Amazon's premium streaming service versus Spotify. I get Spotify does a lot as far as what artists can control and playlists and stuff, but Amazon, as far as I've seen, seems to have streaming pay rates that are 2 to 3 times as much as the other services. It just seems like something artists would want to be sending their listeners to more. Thanks. Look forward to hearing the answer. Yeah.
Thanks for that call and a very good question. And I think we can answer that. First off, Amazon streaming is very small as far as people using it. So our discussion about Spotify grew as Spotify grew to be the streaming leader. So that's one key. Yes, you can link your fans there, but we're at a stage of the music business where it's really your fans' choice where they're going to engage with music. So I subscribe to Spotify. I actually have Amazon Prime, but that's you have to pay extra for the unlimited streaming. You get a very limited streaming package if you just have Amazon Prime. But, you know, I subscribe to Spotify. If an artist sends me Amazon links all day long, I'm not going to click on them because I can't listen. So you really have to gauge your fan base. So our discussion around Spotify has increased over the years as Spotify has become the streaming juggernaut. However, there's other platforms that we've discussed, and it's all been because of the ability for artists to actually do things with the platform. And that's kind of the perfect storm around Spotify is not only have they become the streaming giant, but they allow artists to actually merchandise their music on that. You can change the profile pictures. You can feature a playlist or a latest track and add some more photos. You can change your bio. You can create playlists and a whole lot of things where artists can actually impact what happens on the platform, which is so far away from where we were back in the retail era where a CD sat on a shelf. There was nothing that really an artist could do en masse to impact what happened there in the actual store itself, where that's where we are with Spotify. Amazon doesn't have any of those options. So that's why it's really hard to talk about it strategically, other than saying that if you notice that a large number of your fans are using that platform, then absolutely you should be including those links. Anything to add to that, Chris?
Only my own ignorance, and that whenever I go to Amazon in search of music, it's a very confusing process for me because Amazon could have the CD. They could have multiple sellers selling a CD in vinyl. They probably offer it as a download. And then, you know, through Music Unlimited, there's the stream, and it's just like all these different results. And so maybe I'm just going about it wrong and I need to spend more time researching it, but I find it very scattered. It feels like a very scattered
process. I agree. Even when they just had an MP3 download store, that was separate from where you went to buy a CD, like a totally different spot on the site. And it gets really confusing. So here's my thing with Amazon. If there's anybody that can create an experience that we talk about a ton, it's them. Can they do it? We'll see. I think the recipe for success in the streaming world is largely out there. And it's just a matter of if these companies that have massive reach want to follow suit or if they just want to do their own thing. I think Amazon's one of those that can. And, the book isn't written on streaming. Spotify is it now, but other people can do really cool stuff that make it possible for artists to really want to engage with that platform. But right now, it's not really strategically much you can do with it. If your fans are there, yes. But other than that, not a whole lot. So that's why we don't talk about it much. All right, we've got one last call, and then we're going to get into some emails.
Hey, guys. My name is Sean Lamborn, and I play solo under the name Team Yule, and I also play with a band called The Longest Day of the Year. And I wanted to first say thanks for everything. You guys do an amazing job, and everything really is measurable with results. I can see by using some of your tips and tricks and everything. But my question today is in May of 2017, I released a 4-song EP under my solo name, T. Mule. And on it, I have some amazing people that I played with from bigger, much bigger national bands who played some of the instrumentation on it. And it wasn't until about a month ago that I realized, probably stupidly, that I could have put them as featured artists and gotten in their artist profile, I believe, as also appears on, and that would spread my album even more, my EP even more. So my question is it possible to add them as featured artists now that it's already out and distributed to all the digital retailers, or can I add them and have that them as featured artists pushed out to, say, Spotify, or would I have to take the whole EP down and re-upload it again? And if I had to do that, do you think it would be worth it? Truthfully, I don't have a ton of monthly listeners or plays right now, and, you know, always working on that. And so just wondering what you think about that. Really appreciate your time and look forward to hearing what you have to say. Thank you.
That was a good question, and it brought up something that I hadn't really thought much about before, in that being, what is a featured artist and what is not? Traditionally, what that has meant really has been like another famous name that's usually singing or fronting a song in some way or a major part of the collaboration. Would you agree with that, Chris? Or would you call it something else?
You know, I agree with that, and I would not necessarily think of a featured artist as someone you hired to be kind of the backing band for your project. That being said, if they are featured in some way, it might be worth exploring what you're talking about.
The only other way that I've, you know, featured artist has been used a lot, like Santana is a perfect example. He's a guitar player, a known name, and he got other known names to sing songs. Here's one thing to consider. If you have, I believe it's more than four tracks that you mark as featured artists, some of the services will turn it into require it to be a compilation album. So you don't want to go crazy with this. It's not a compilation album you're making. Also, I emailed our guy here who is head of all of our digital ops I emailed him your voicemail to get his take. You know, we can do a metadata update, so you wouldn't have to redistribute it through us. It's already distributed. We can do a metadata update. You can start that process within your CD Baby account in the digital distribution section. But here's what he said. You may want to emphasize in your podcast that clients should not include names of band members already noted under the primary artist. Like, just because a band member rips out a monster guitar solo in a song doesn't mean is also a featuring artist. He said also, if the song has already been out for some time, then it probably shouldn't be getting tinkered with, or it might cause customer confusion. Now, if lots of people haven't seen it, then probably no big deal. So basically, MJ, our guy here at CD Baby, was saying, that if they're a featured artist, like if you got hot session guys, that like studio named guys that people in that world know, I wouldn't consider that a featured artist, like someone that just played a guitar solo, or I hired a great backing band, like Chris said, unless that backing band was a known entity of themselves. So you really got to decipher, is it truly a featured artist scenario, or did they just come play a track on your record?
Yeah, there's a lot to consider, because if they are the backing band, if they're a known entity and they're the backing band on every track on the record, there's an argument for, you know, it being your name and so-and-so, in which case it's like a compound artist. And like you said, it would appear under both artists' discographies. But that's also probably more than they thought they were getting into. You know, it's not like they were signing on to make your record so it would show up as their record.
That's a good point, because somebody who maybe is a really known session player that has solo albums that they're known for, and you paid them to come do a guitar solo, they might have just been doing it for the money. And maybe they don't want to be considered a featured artist on your record, in the sense that now that gets tagged on their profile. You know, that's something to consider. So it may involve them giving some sign-off as well. Now, there is no mechanism for that right now, but I could see that being an issue in the future as more and more of what people work on gets tagged in certain ways, and how do I curate my own profile and allow for certain featured products, featured artist placements to come through and others not?
Yeah. And I mean, whatever the caller decides to do, I would say don't do anything unless you have their blessing and they know what the results of the changes would be. And it reminded me of Lance Allen, the friend of CD Baby, who has been earning enough money from streaming to pay off his mortgage every month. And he's an instrumental guitarist. And I've been talking with him over the past couple weeks on Facebook. And his new thing that he's trying to take his Pandora and Spotify game to the next level is to do all duets that are going to show up as compound artists. So it's like Lance Allen, comma, whoever else the artist is, you know, whoever he's duetting with. And then every single thing he puts out is going to be listed in two places. And we'll be drawing upon the following and all of the activity of both of the artists.
You need to write an article for the DIY Musician blog that details compound artist versus feature artist, the benefits of both, and describe the difference.
Yes.
Because I want to read that article because I want to know. I've this compound artist thing. When you were saying that, I was, because we've on our upcoming Small Town Poets album, which might be pushed back to 2018 or 19 at this point. Who knows? Who knows if it'll ever come out this year? But our next Small Town Poets album, we have a duet on a song that we co-wrote with a lead singer of a very famous band in our genre. And I've been itching to get that one out because of some of these things. Both I'm hoping some crossover from their fan base will enjoy the song and follow along with what we're doing now, but also trying to figure out how to properly attribute it.
Well, the compound artist thing is important too if you're a solo artist who also occasionally works with a backing band, because this thing will happen where I had Chris Robley in The Fear of Heights. Those records where the artist name was Chris Robley and The Fear of Heights weren't showing up on my Chris Robley discography, which, you know, I have three or four solo albums under that name. And those Fear of Heights records weren't being pulled into that same place because it was listed just as a single artist name as opposed to a compound artist being Chris Robley, comma, The Fear of Heights. So also important if you want all of your stuff together, if you have your name in all of the acts.
Yeah. Interesting. The digital world has provided so many new interesting problems for us.
Now, again, I'm going to refer you to Black Mirror.
I will start maybe tonight. Needed something new to binge on anyway, you know. All right. Thanks for all those calls. Again, if you want to call the listener line, 360-524-2209. All those calls were the perfect length. They got to the point, and I still felt like we heard enough of their story to understand the question. So feel free to call in. We've got a couple emails we're going to get to. They actually kind of go in succession, and you'll understand why. This first one is from somebody named Theory. I think that's, I'm pronouncing their name right. It's T-H-I-E-R-R-Y. Hi, Kevin and Chris. My name is Theory. I recently became a fan of your podcast and have gone through about 30 episodes in 2 months on my daily commute. I'm part of a Belgian Dutch language rap group called Gwan Ruban. I think that's how you pronounce it. They put it phonetically, spelled it out, and I still, I'm sure, got it wrong. Our songs are in the dialect of our 100,000 inhabitant city with a very small hip hop scene. So you can imagine our core audience isn't the biggest. Your tips and tricks on the podcast are really helping us reach more people and expand that audience. We'll never become superstars, but it's nice to know that thanks to our improved communication, we now at least reach the people who want to hear our music. Before, we would put lots of work in new songs and then get asked, oh, you have a new release? Even by our biggest fans, so thank you. As an IP attorney by day, it's also interesting to hear you discussing copyright issues on the podcast. This is where I got nervous when I was reading this email initially. I have one remark though. Could you please, please, please mention to your listeners that the rules and regulations you guys and your guests talk about are for the US. You have mentioned that you have a lot of listeners from outside the US. While the general ideas are often the same, there are some very important differences between, for instance, US copyright law and Belgian copyright law. I know from practice that people who aren't in the legal field don't always take this into account, and it creates lots of confusion. Greetings. Thanks. Theory. Well, thank you for that email. Yes, I should be more upfront with our discussions that pertain to any laws around music, that it is going to be a U.S.-centric opinion and viewpoint, and that there are different laws in different countries and some in Europe where there are some differences, especially the way things like royalties, the laws around royalties and certain copyright issues. So if you have questions and you aren't in the U.S., you should definitely check into your local country's laws, especially if you're like, that doesn't sound right. I thought it was a little different. Well, it might be. So thank you for reminding us to mention that. And that group in doing hip hop in a Dutch language that's a dialect of 100,000 people seems very interesting. If anything, you've got a great story and the great making of a documentary around that.
Quite the niche.
Yeah. And I hope that we'll be seeing Theory at the DIY Musician Conference in Valencia, because, I mean, that's like a $50 plane ride from Belgium. No reason why. No reason why.
We'll see you there.
All right. The legal issues continue. That's why I thought it was fitting that I make that statement ahead of time with this next email. Hi, Kevin and Chris. Thanks once again so much for the podcast. You're doing a fantastic job, and I'm very grateful for all the hours spent listening to you. I have a question that I think you might help me with. I came to think of an idea of a song where I would use a lot of short quotes from different famous movies. Sing them in a way so that people know they are from the movies. For example, "You Shall Not Pass," or "What We Do in This Life Echoes in Eternity," or "You Know Nothing, Jon Snow." Question is, are these quotes trademarked or copyrighted in some way so that I can't use them in my song? Would it be illegal, or could the company sue me if I use them? Best regards, Max from Sweden. Wow, we're just going international today.
Yeah.
Well, Max,
I was going to say the answer, if he were in the US, is yes, no, maybe. I have no idea. And that's even more the case if you're in Sweden.
Chris, that's funny that you say that, because I asked our in-house counsel, Joel, what the answer to this question would be. And like a good lawyer, he wrote back a giant reply. And here's his reply. I'm going to read it. As usual, best to follow up with an expert in person on this, because there are a lot of little things that would add up to a yes or no. But there are a few things you should know in advance. First, most likely, this is copyright infringement, but don't stop there. We'll get to some good stuff in a second. Copyright infringement has a lot of technical analysis to the facts at hand, but really, it is just someone else copying your copyrights without your permission. Here, it's pretty clear that someone owns the copyrights to both the scripts and audiovisual works that include these lines. You would then be copying lines from their scripts without permission, which is essentially copyright infringement. If you created these lines yourself without copying anyone, it could change things, but that's not the case here. So cleanest thing to do is get permission. Reach out to the studios, get a license. Probably not the easiest thing or cheapest, but definitely cleanest. My little side note here, they will never get back to you on that one. So just so you know. However, even if you are infringing, there might be some good defense that will make your use of these lines okay. One defense is called fair use, where you can use the copyrights of others without permission, so long as that use is fair. An example of fair use is where music critics get to list out parts of your lyrics from songs in the articles they write. They are using these lyrics often without permission, but because they are essentially transforming those lyrics into critiques in a music article, that use can be deemed fair. Another potential defense is called de minimis, and if you're going to use a Maximus quote, you may as well look up the translation for this Latin phrase. De minimis is where the use of someone else's copyright is such a small or minimal use that courts shouldn't really have to deal with it. An example of de minimis is something unintentionally in the background, such as a pinball machine in the background of a set on a film that appears for 30 seconds in a 2-hour long film. Sure, that pinball machine includes designs and images that are copyrighted, but it would be inappropriate for a court to weigh in on the copyright infringement because the use is so small. The catch with copyright infringement defenses is that they can only be certified in court after it's proven you are a copyright infringer. You can look at the four factors of fair use and come up with a good legal argument in advance, or you could look at previous cases and try to compare whether your ratio of lines from films in your song is de minimis, but it is tricky whether you can be sure about your defense. And that's where meeting with an expert in person would be super important. So that was the response from our in-house counsel. And that response was far more detailed than I was expecting. I was expecting no, that's copyright infringement. But actually, a little background, the reason why I was curious and didn't just tell Max from Sweden, no, don't do that, was because a movie comprises a whole lot of words. And if any line from a movie could be considered copyright infringement, then we'd pretty much have a grinding halt to the languages we use, because movies are full of just common conversation. So I think, to me, here, Max is definitely trying to draw imagery in people's minds from those movies. So that's where I think it's clear that it's probably copyright infringement. Now, the only thing that I can think of, again, I am not a lawyer. The only thing that I can think of that may fall under fair use is if it's done in parody form, which could change things. And Weird Al is somebody who's done a lot of things that walk this line. It clearly has to be comedic parody, but even the definition of that has been challenged over the years. To me, it sounds like it's not worth the trouble. I can guarantee you a movie studio is never going to get back to you on using that.
It's probably not worth the trouble. Maybe it's something you write and you perform live and just don't ever record it. And don't let anyone
And I'm assuming the execution will be good. Otherwise, it may also come under artistic merit scrutiny of, is this a good idea to begin with? That's always something to consider as well. Max of Sweden. Oh, that's his artist name as well. I just saw that note. I hope to see you at the DIY Musician Conference in Valencia, Spain in April. It'll be much sunnier and warmer.
I love how the assumption is just that anyone that lives in Europe needs to be in Spain, because it's just a stone's
Everything
throw,
is.
Right?
Other Everyone. Countries are...
I mean, it is more of a stone's throw there.
Chris, you're farther away right. from me in the United States than probably most of Europe is from our Valencia conference.
From anywhere yes. else in Europe?
Yes.
Right.
You can get anywhere in Europe on a 2-hour plane ride that costs like $100. So, Max, I will be seeing you there.
Right,
it'll be sunnier and warmer in yeah. April in Valencia than it will be in Sweden. So it just makes for a good time.
And Maine.
Than it is for you in Maine, yes. Correct. That is also true. Well, that's all our calls and emails. Thanks so much. Again, 360-524-2209, podcast at cdbabypodcast.com, or weigh in at the show notes at the podcast website. I love when we get calls that cause me to do some digging to find the answer, because a new scenario like that featured artist thing, that's something that's really starting to pop up more. And that was fun to kind of go track down that info. Or, you know, getting, now that we have an in-house counsel with Joel, getting him involved with some of these questions is a lot easier. And he gives nice detailed responses. And so lots of good stuff there. Again, we mentioned it a few times throughout the show, but it is time to buy your tickets for the DIY Musician Conference in Nashville and the one in Valencia, Spain. It's such a great time for us to get together with the podcast community. It's so fun to meet you guys face to face and actually feel like we start building a real relationship. It's not just this podcast relationship. It's real. We're taking it into the real world. And those conferences are a great place to do that and meet other folks from CD Baby and artists in your community. I know a lot of people that I've talked to that are European artists have been wanting to know, how do I tour around Europe more? How do I get to the States to tour? And these are great ways to just hang with other artists and ask those questions and learn from a community. And that's the beauty of it. So head on over to DIYMusicianCon.com for tickets, or DIYMusicianCon.com/Europe for the Valencia conference. And Chris, with that, we're gonna sign off. We'll catch you later. Bye. We'll
You've been listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.